But what I really came down to was that there's sort of a philosophical alignment between unschooling, the unschooling philosophy, and what these parents were trying to do with their lifestyles. And I think the families in my study really share kind of like a personality profile. They are really dedicated to individual freedom and personal liberties. They are very much emphasizing things like self-reliance and independence and a kind of do-it-yourselfness, right? I kind of like even refer in the book to how this is kind of like a DIY lifestyle, mm-hmm. right? And to this idea that everybody is different and special and unique. So the unschooling philosophy really dovetails with those ideas and those values, because unschooling promotes each child's unique talents and interests. It really focuses on developing the child's independence and self-reliance as a learner. So that's kind of where I saw unschooling and world schooling as being quite parallel.
That's Dr. Jenny Moles. She's a professor of sociology at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, and the author of the book, The World is Our Classroom: Extreme Parenting and the Rise of World Schooling. Drawing on interviews with parents and stories from the blogs they published during their journeys, as well as her own experience traveling the world with her 10-year-old son, she takes us inside a fascinating life spent on trains, boats, and planes. She shows why many parents, disillusioned with standard public schooling, believe the world is a child's best classroom. Rebelling against convention, these parents combine technology and travel to pursue a different version of the good life, one in which parents can work remotely as digital nomads, participate in like-minded communities, and expose their children to the risks, opportunities, and life lessons that the world has to offer. So grab a seat by the fire as we discuss how more and more families are choosing the world as their classroom. So we'd like to welcome Dr. Jenny Gurman Moles. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes, so you are currently in New Mexico, which has a big place in our heart. We just spoke about that before we started, that we used to live out there. And you also are a professor in the area that I grew up, so very small world. But can you just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you, your family, and what it is that you do?
Yeah, hi. So thanks for having me. I am a professor of sociology at College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, which, like you said, Nathan, isn't far from where you grew up. But I've kind of been stranded out here in New Mexico during the pandemic, teaching online, which I have to say hasn't been too bad for me. So I'm a sociologist, but I kind of consider myself a mobilities scholar, which means that I am interested in the way social life is sort of predicated on these intersecting mobilities and immobilities. And I'm especially interested in how people do togetherness on the move. So my first book, Travel Connections, was about how tourists were using mobile technologies and social media to kind of maintain togetherness with these dispersed social networks while they were traveling. And now my new book on world schooling is also looking at how families do family life and family togetherness on the move.
And that's going to come out next month, correct?
Yes, it's due to come out in February.
All right. You excited?
I can't wait to see it. Yeah, I am excited. It's been a long, long time in process. I did my field work in 2014, 2015, and then it took a long time to write the book, and then, you know, going through revisions and production and everything. So I'll be very happy to get that book in my hands.
So yeah, why don't we start with your field work? Because that's when you and your family actually world schooled, correct?
That's right.
And to start, before you go into that, can you first answer the question, was your child, because you stated you had one child, correct? Mm-hmm. Was he in a traditional school setting when you made that decision?
That's a great question. And there's kind of a little bit of a long story behind it. Okay. So I'll just tell you. So the idea for world schooling, well, really, world schooling wasn't even a word yet when I had the idea that I wanted to research this phenomenon. What happened was when I was researching my first book, Travel Connections, I was doing research on travel bloggers, and I happened to get a couple of families in my sample. So most of my travel bloggers were like 20-something single people, you know, traveling the world. But there were a couple of people were doing it with their families. And I thought, hey, this would be a great thing to follow up on in a future research project. So in the meantime, I got a Fulbright and my family and I went to Finland. We went to the University of Lapland and we lived in Rovaniemi for 6 months. And it was while we were there that I kind of hatched this plan of doing world schooling as the field work for my next project. And at that time, up until then, Elliot, my son, had been in public school. But when we moved to Finland, we actually enrolled him in a Steiner school, which is, I guess we know it as Waldorf mm-hmm. in the United States, but he was going to a Steiner school there. And this was kind of his first exposure to an alternative education experience. And the school he went to on Mondays, they did all outdoor education. They didn't even go inside at all, even when it was like minus 20 degrees Celsius.
Yep.
And so he was really having this interesting experience. And so at that point, I asked him if he might be open to maybe traveling some more, like doing this some more, right? And we were sitting at the table when I asked him about this, and he got up and he left, and I was like, oh no. And he came back with a piece of paper and a pencil, and he said, okay, let's list out all the places we want to go.
How old was he?
He was 8 at that time. That's awesome. Then we actually did the world schooling trip when he was 10.
Oh, great. Yeah, we just interviewed somebody from Scandinavia, and she was telling us all about the schools there. And it is, like you said, an alternative education for sure. Their schools are very different and they embrace the outdoors no matter the weather. It sounds amazing out there. We just don't have enough of those over here in the States quite yet.
I think that we're getting more and more
yes,
of those yeah. kinds of options. Yeah.
So you then made the decision to, do your field work, right? When you asked him if he wanted to travel more.
Right. So then I was able, I knew I had a sabbatical coming up and that I would have time to do some really intensive field work during that sabbatical. So we tried to schedule, taking him out of school for a year, which would have been fifth grade for him. We took him out of school and we organized our itinerary at that point.
And so what did your field work / traveling around the world look like?
So my field work uses an approach that I call mobile virtual ethnography. So it's a combination of virtual ethnography where I was studying and following the blogs that world schooling families were publishing. And again, the word world schooling wasn't really around yet. Like it kind of came, became more popular a little bit afterwards, but I was following them online. And then we established an itinerary to travel around the world for 7 months. And my intention with that was to try to spend a lot of time in the hubs where these traveling families also tended to get together. Because they were using the internet to connect with one another and even to meet up in person while they were traveling. So I wanted to be sure to put places like Chiang Mai, Thailand, and Buenos Aires, and a couple other places where these families that tend to be family-friendly destinations onto the itinerary. My husband and my son had a little bit more ambitious idea. They wanted to go to all 7 continents. And so we compromised. We did what they wanted to do. we went to all 7 continents, but we still were able to spend a good chunk of time in these places where I wanted to be to meet up with families.
And so what did learning look like for you guys then?
So this was interesting. And this was, I was really glad that I was doing world schooling with Elliot while also researching it, because I think it would have been hard to kind of get a sense of the challenges families really, really face mm-hmm. when they hit the road. And we, I think, were very conventional in our mindset at first. We did all of the preparation to contact the superintendent and let him know our intention to take Elliot out of school and give a plan of the curriculum we would be following. And I downloaded all of the curriculum for fifth grade for our school district. And I downloaded, you know, the power standards and the, you know, learning goals. And I had, you know, I had everything in a folder, and we had an iPad. So I downloaded a lot of textbooks and texts for Elliot. And we had this idea that, okay, so every day he'll do, you know, an hour of math, an hour of reading, and then we'll, you know, whatever. So so what I quickly discovered in my family, which I also discovered with a lot of the families that I interviewed, is that this goes out the window pretty quickly when you are trying to also organize catching trains and sightseeing, or trying to take advantage of what the place you're in has to offer. So in the book, I write about one of the parents in my study talks about becoming an accidental unschooler. And I think this is what a lot of families sort of stumble into unschooling, and we did as well. We kind of just went with the flow. What's going on in the world around us? What's going on today that we can kind of tap into that, you know, might expand Elliot's worldview and ours too? I mean, we were also learning constantly along the way. So it kind of boiled down to something more like Elliot was keeping a blog. So that was, you know, writing. Yeah. We would sort of task him with little math problems throughout the day. Like, okay, if, you know, if this costs, you know, 30 baht in Thai currency, how much is that in US money, or, you know, little things like that. And then he did have quite a few online resources that he liked to do. For geography, he loved this game called Stack the Countries. Mm-hmm. I don't know if your kids have come across that, but it's a pretty silly game, but he learned geography really well through that. And then he had another website called IXL that he could do little like reading and math games. So
actually, yeah, my sister's a math teacher, and she did recommend that website to our listeners when there were a lot of sudden school at home families when COVID hit. She did praise IXL. No, I'm glad you shared on how you reacted to that change, because that is the biggest part. We always speak on I think the biggest challenge is for the parent to de-school and let go of what we think is normal for education. And that's great that you were studying it and were able to kind of like train your brain, like, yep, this is normal, it's going to be okay. Cause it's kind of scary too, as a parent, to just let go of what you know and accept what's more natural to us, I feel like.
That goes just not for world schooling, but I think anybody who ends up homeschooling or doing any type of alternative education, if you yourself had gone to public schools, you're constantly thinking that maybe you're doing something wrong because it doesn't look like the school that you went to. And on top of it, you're a professor at a university. So Was it extremely tough for you to let go of those, or did it just come naturally and slowly over time during your travels?
I think I should probably qualify this by saying that it depends on the kid. I think it depends on the kid what the parent's reaction is going to be. In our case, Elliot just has always kind of been really self-motivated and self-disciplined, and he likes to learn. He loves to learn. So we were never in a position where I felt anxious, because it was pretty clear that he was exploring and he was curious and he was reading and he was, you know, doing these things. I think if he had become like, you know, I think some kids become quite homesick and maybe a little bit sullen or uncooperative, maybe. Mm-hmm. I may have been more anxious about, like, oh gosh, what's he doing? So in that case, maybe I had it easier. But at the same time, I think, you know, I had read a lot of John Taylor Gatto and Ivan Illich's work. So I kind of, you know, I knew this process of de-schooling, and I knew a lot of the critiques about conventional schooling. In my own analysis, I don't think I go quite as far as they go. So because I myself have benefited enormously from the conventional schooling that I've had, but I felt okay with it. Yeah, and I had read a lot of John Holt's work too, right? So I could kind of see that Eliot was sort of doing what these these educational philosophers and these thinkers had predicted would happen.
Obviously, it's a big change up for your family and especially your son. What changes did you see during your 7 months of travel, and not only yourselves, but your child? Did you see like massive changes in him as far as what he was experiencing through the travels?
All of us, of course. You know, travel, I think traveling with your family, I think accelerates and crystallizes everything that's already there, right? So we all kind of went through our emotional ups and downs throughout the journey. And Martin and I had traveled a lot in our 20s. We had backpacked around the world, and we had lived in Asia for several years. And Eliot was actually born in England. We lived in England for 6 years. So this wasn't entirely new to us. But it was, of course, you know, you have to tap into a whole lot of practical knowledge and emotional reserves to kind of make it happen, right? With Eliot, I think fifth grade is such a beautiful age, right? I mean, I think when kids are 10, that's just such a, that's a transformative age wherever you are, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that it was really nice to kind of see him become more independent, become a little bit more voicing his ideas about things, you know, his ideas about where we should go and what we should eat. And the other thing was that I think having Eliot as part of the dynamic kept things fun, right? I think that that Martin and I, my husband Martin and I, can be quite like practical minded. And with Eliot, we had to keep fun in there too, right? He wanted to explore things and do things that maybe didn't fit the schedule, but were definitely made it more joyful.
That is a magical age. We have a daughter who will be 10 soon. And just this past year, you can see them bloom so much and becoming this different person with that independent thinking. And she wants so much. It's all of a sudden this age is like they know what things that they want to go explore, and the creativity is starting to come out, and that is a prime time to travel. That's pretty awesome. We like to ask, were there any like extraordinary moments that you remember where you're like, oh man, that was amazing, just because we love to hear that about traveling?
I honestly, there are just too many to recount. I mean, there were so many wonderful experiences, hard experiences, scary experiences.
You can share them too.
The scary ones were, I think the scariest one was when we lost Eliot in a shopping mall in Singapore.
Yeah, scary.
That was scary. And the funny thing is he had sort of done everything right. He had the iPad, and he used the iPad to text us to tell us where he was, but we didn't have any phone service. So it wasn't until we were able to get into Wi-Fi and kind of like get his message and then go and find him. So it's like, oh wow, that was really like resourceful of him. I was pretty proud of him for thinking that through. But I think really the most the most extraordinary moments we had were, you know, we were talking earlier about, we're such an outdoor family. We love to be outside and to hike and, you know, swim and do all that kind of stuff. So I think those to me are the times that stand out the most is when we were camping or doing things outside. Elliot and I took surfing lessons in Australia, right? And I guess this is sort of an extraordinary moment. So we're doing these surfing lessons. We're both like, of course he's awesome at it and I'm terrible at it. So this idea that parents are teaching kids it's not a hierarchy like that at all, right? Like we're all in this together, learning together. And as we're on the surfboards out in the surf across the beach, this parade of people dressed with in like huge feather wings and these huge, these big costumes just walked across the beach and left. And Ellie and I just kind of looked at each other and like shrugged like, yeah.
A sight to be seen.
Well, how'd you like surfing? I grew up surfing.
Did you? Oh, let's just say Elliot's way better at it than I.
I give you credit for trying because I don't even know if I could get myself to actually stand on the board. I am so not coordinated.
I think I stood up one time.
That would be me.
It's just the act of being out there on the water. That's good enough sometimes. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful experience surfing.
Oh, yeah. It was fun.
Awesome. So you travel for 7 months, travel around the world, and then you come home, finish your research. The next year, what does that transition look like for Elliot going back to traditional school, or did he?
So to say that Elliot had a 180 would be an understatement. We came back to Massachusetts and we actually enrolled Elliot in a small Catholic prep academy in Worcester because he had some friends there and it was a lot closer to where I was teaching. And so he went from wearing flip-flops every day to wearing a uniform with a tie. And yeah, Nathan, I feel how uncomfortable that is just imagining that, right?
I always said a tie is the dumbest invention ever made. You're literally tying a rope around your neck for some reason. I don't understand it. Why that became a thing.
I went to Catholic school, so I understand.
Yeah, you get it, right? So, and it was very strict, very rigorous. I remember he came home and was doing his science. He was writing up a science lab and he had a ruler and he was using the ruler to measure the margins on his paper because his teacher had very specific directions for what the margins on your science lab report had to be. And I was like, oh no. But in reality, Elliot, he really thrived in that situation too. He loved the structure. He loved his teacher. He ended up that science teacher became his favorite teacher, because in reality, what the science teacher was doing was sort of creating a structure that then later allowed for more experimentation and for more like discussion and playfulness. So I eventually saw where he was going with that. Although that first day, I was like, oh. But yeah, so that was a real shift. But I told Elliot, and I've you know, we've talked about this a lot too. You know, going to school is of course about learning whatever it is that the curriculum has laid out for you, but it's also about learning how these institutions work, right? So he had spent a few years in public school, so he knew how the institution of public school worked, and he knew what world schooling looked like, and he knew what the Waldorf school model looked like. Now he was learning what a Catholic prep school looked like. And now for high school, he goes to a really innovative hybrid school that half the curriculum is online and half is offline. And of course it's all online now. So I told him, you know, you've had an education, but you've also had an education in all the different ways that schooling and learning can be organized. Mm-hmm. So
that's a beautiful thing in itself. Did he have, does he, has he said that he's preferred one way, or he likes different things about each style?
Oh, the world schooling was by far his favorite. Yeah, he didn't want to stop that.
I don't blame him.
At least he got a taste of it. You know, not all kids are able to get that. So that's really neat.
Yes.
You never know what it'll do for him in the future.
So you sent us an article and kind of an outline of your book, since it wasn't out yet, for us to kind of prepare to have this conversation. And each of them discuss your research on world schooling that you did. And can you give us a brief overview of what your research was really honed in on? And then we'll ask some questions, a little bit more detailed questions after that, but just kind of an idea of what your research during your travels was really focused on.
Sure. So when I hatched the idea for this book, originally my question was to, I wanted to look at more of these families that I had seen in my previous research. So I started following about 50 blogs that were being published by families. And then I started reaching out to some families and interviewing people online, and then eventually meeting up and interviewing people in person, and even sort of, hanging out and traveling with some of these families a little bit as part of the field work. The question I started with was, how are people doing family life on the move? Because we often assume that family life takes place kind of like in the home or within a really small orbit of, around the home. But of course, we know that that's not true for vast numbers of families who are migrating, who are geographically dispersed, who are on the move in different ways. So I was curious about how these families were doing family life while living a traveling lifestyle. But that pretty quickly shifted. And what I started to realize was that these families were sort of opting into a mobile lifestyle as a way of resisting or sort of maybe taking charge of their lives against the backdrop of economic insecurity, right? So this is sort of following on from the 2008 financial crisis, and also in the wake of social uncertainties that have arisen in the wake of different neoliberal policies, right? Where individuals are more and more responsible for their own healthcare and their own education and their own retirement plan, and the government is offering less and less in terms of social welfare programs. And so that creates this sort of uncertainty and competitiveness in society that these families just felt really uncomfortable with, or they were uncomfortable with the way they felt constrained in their sort of suburban lifestyles. So what I ended up really looking at in the research was how these families were using a mobile lifestyle as a, not just a solution to uncertainty, but as a way of harnessing that uncertainty to kind of create a more fun and liberated life for themselves.
And you kind of just hit on this a little bit, but what were some of the reasons you found as to why families decided to world school? I'm sure there's many reasons why people decide to do this. But before I let you answer, I wanted to, read two blog posts that you had in the article that you sent us, because I thought they were awesome. When I read them, I kind of get the goosebumps, because it just really hits home, I think, for a lot of people. But it's not just for world schooling. It's really for anything in life, like stepping out of the norm or doing something that you've always wanted to do and just going to do it. But let me read these first, because I thought they were great that you had them in the article, and then you can answer the question. So the first one you had was from Mark. I guess it was a blog post. And he said, "You only live once. The phrase is so overused. But if you really stop and think about it, you realize that you had better make the most of life, because chances are pretty good that this is the only one you're going to get. I recognize that this change that we're making is a huge responsibility, but I also know what a privilege it is, and I don't intend to take it for granted or to waste it. I know we can't live like there's no tomorrow, but we're also not going to live like we know there is." And the second was from Kyle. He said, "So much freedom, so much choice, so many opportunities to do something amazing. and yet it is our natural instinct to find a place to hold us, a spot where we are safe from the obligation, opportunity to choose. Because if we choose and we are responsible and we have to take risks, and risks are scary because they make us vulnerable. And I think that hits home to anybody in life that has always wanted to do something different and is afraid to take that first step.
So I think you can sense in both of those some of the motivations behind why families are making this decision. And I was also really curious about why parents were doing this. Even in 2014, this was a pretty radical move. I think it's become a little bit more mainstream recently, but at the time it was a pretty radical move. And so I was curious what made it, feasible for them, right? Well, what made it viable to make this decision? And I found several motivations, like as you guessed, right? It's not just one motivation. One motivation has to do with a critique of conventional schooling. So a lot of the parents in my study were, if not really unhappy, they were just sort of maybe meh, like not super excited about what their kids' schooling experiences were looking like. And so part of it was a critique or wanting to get out of that institutional system. And in my book, I have a chapter called Spark and Fidget. And in that chapter, I outline how parents are worried that their kids are losing their spark in sort of institutional school settings. They're losing their curiosity, they're losing their creativity, they're kind of being, forced to do standardized testing and standardized curricula. And so they were worried about their kids losing that. And then other parents, or maybe even the same parents, were also becoming really concerned about the rise in diagnoses of ADD and ADHD. And they were worried that their kids' fidgetiness, natural, right, this very kind of natural embodied movement, especially among young boys, but not just boys, that they were worried that their kids were going to get labeled with a diagnosis that would then follow them in ways that might limit who they could be or how they could be. So that was one motivation, right, was to kind of sidestep that the pathologizing of their kid, what they saw as their kid's natural, like, wonderfulness. Mm-hmm. Of course, boys want to run around and chat and be silly, or of their curiosity and spark. And other parents were also critical of this. They had this sense that schools were built on this like factory model that may have served the industrial economy of the last century, but weren't really getting their kids ready for the knowledge economy of what's coming. Mm-hmm. So that was one big motivation, was to do something different, an alternative to that. Another motivation was really parents themselves wanted to get out of the box, right? Out of the cubicle, out of the cul-de-sac, out of, what they kind of were beginning to feel as like a hyper-consumerist, materialistic, competitive lifestyle. And they just wanted to kind of do something different. And in both of those motivations, I think those were their explicit motivations, right? That they're saying, this is why we're doing it. And then in my analysis, I'm kind of inferring that the more implicit motivation then is to prepare for this uncertain future, right? Get their kids ready for this uncertain future, to kind of deal with uncertainty, and maybe even to capture some of the flexibility and the freedoms of this uncertainty to launch themselves onto a different avenue or onto a different path in life.
Mm. Can you explain a little bit? What do you mean by that? They're projecting them onto a different path in life. How do you mean?
Well, where they're kind of, a lot of the parents in my study actually resigned from their corporate jobs, from their 9-to-5 jobs. Sold their houses, got rid of their mortgage, got rid of all their stuff, took their kids out of school and just got on a plane, right? And just started traveling the world. And in the hopes that that would open their eyes and their kids' eyes to just other ways of being in the world that aren't necessarily dictated by SAT prep tutoring and, you know, really competitive soccer league and all the kind of accoutrements of that kind of a lifestyle.
Sure. They were looking for a reset basically for their lives as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which we've noticed a lot of with the families we've been interviewing, that it's all circling back to that they are looking for that reset and doing it in different ways.
We just interviewed several like road schoolers that are driving around the country or down into South America, Mexico, South America. And the majority of them, it was that a lot of them were very successful people, but their success didn't necessarily bring happiness. And they felt like there was a gaping hole in their lives. And it was not always a decision that was made on the spot. Some they took years to make the decision and research it before they implemented it. But you find that it's not always, I almost think it's more so that than it is the unhappiness with the education that they're in at the moment their child's in. Mm-hmm. It was more so just an entire lifestyle change that they felt was necessary for them and their family, which is understandable because the more the world speeds up and things get more complicated, at some point you hit a boiling point with people, some people, where they just realize that things aren't that important and life has passed you by it in some sense. And they take that leap of faith to make a change, which I love hearing those stories. Those are my favorite stories to hear because most people won't ever do that. What's the quote? Most men lead lives of quiet desperation, right? And to be able to make that change, that it's not your reality, is selling your house and hitting the road, which I think is really cool that people do that.
Yes, that was the common ground we kept seeing. I felt like they kept using the term rat race. They were stuck in the rat race and they just wanted to simplify. And it was things like selling everything and realizing they didn't need a whole lot to be happy. And it did come down to the lifestyle. That's been what we've seen so far, more so than the educational component.
The metaphor that kept coming up in my research was rat race and the treadmill. Mm-hmm. And I thought this was really interesting because these are both really mobile metaphors, right? But it's a mobility that just keeps you stuck rather than a mobility that opens up other possibilities. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I thought it was really interesting to think about how these families were using mobility as a strategy in their lives.
No, it is. That's really interesting. That's why I love your work. I think it's so neat to actually be researching that.
Yeah, you can't beat that for research. It's taking a sabbatical, traveling around the world with your family and speaking with and interviewing world schooling families. Doesn't get much better than that. You know how lucky you are, right?
Yeah.
So in the documents you shared with us, you state that there is that tendency among world schoolers to adopt this unschooling approach, which you kind of talked about earlier. Why do you think that is? You spoke about it in your article, and if you could just share your thoughts on that a little bit more than what you had said earlier.
I was surprised, and I love it when research surprises me. I was surprised at how many of the families in my sample were adopting an unschooling approach. So I really delved into this quite a bit to try to understand why they were doing that. And I found that there were practical reasons, which I kind of mentioned when I told my story. Practically, unschooling travels much better than big heavy textbooks and strict schedules and, you know, testing protocols and that kind of thing. Like unschooling just travels well logistically. And travel feeds into unschooling really well also, right? Because if you're traveling, you're kind of constantly putting things in front of your family's face that they can make sense of. And that kind of prompts the kind of learning that unschooling is meant to do. So practically, it just travels well. Pedagogically, it aligns really well with these parents who definitely adopt this belief that travel is inherently educational, right? That just traveling is going to teach you something about yourself and about the world. And if you can kind of, you know, guide it a little bit, it can really do that quite in quite a transformative way. But what I really came down to was that there's sort of a philosophical alignment between unschooling, the unschooling philosophy, and what these parents were trying to do with their lifestyles. And I think the families in my study really share kind of like a personality profile. They are really dedicated to individual freedom and personal liberties. They are very much emphasizing things like self-reliance and independence and a kind of do-it-yourselfness, right? I kind of like even refer in the book to how this is kind of like a DIY lifestyle, mm-hmm. right? And to this idea that everybody is different and special and unique. So the unschooling philosophy really dovetails with those ideas and those values, because unschooling promotes each child's unique talents and interests. It really focuses on developing the child's independence and self-reliance as a learner. So that's kind of where I saw unschooling and world schooling as being quite parallel.
Now, this is just something that I think anybody wonders that has never unschooled or world schooled. So I'll ask you a personal question. When you came home, did you feel like your son was behind in any way whatsoever when it came to like traditional education?
So again, I have to refer back to that caveat that Elliot is quite like a self-motivated sure. learner. No, not in the least. He, in order to enroll in the academy I mentioned, he had to take a placement test and he just aced it.
That's what we like. That's kind of what I was hoping to hear from you, that he was not behind in any way. And I understand that it depends on the child, but I would say most children that are in a family that does something like this typically end up being self-reliant, self-motivated, and enjoy learning on their own at some point, because that's just when you stick most kids in that situation, it's a natural thing for them to be like that. Mm-hmm. When you don't crush their soul every day in certain environments, right? So I think that's really neat to hear.
Mm-hmm. It also gives you the opportunity to go down those rabbit holes when you're traveling. I mean, really, unschooling is the way with that interest-led, child-led learning. So understandably so, I feel like it would make most sense to just kind of like, okay, we're going here and what do you find interesting? And let's go down that rabbit hole of learning.
Which is one of our favorite things to do.
Yes, yeah. While we're on the topic, in your research, these were kind of new terminologies for me, but you discuss how world schooling families focus on, quote, emotional curriculum and transformative learning. Can you briefly describe what these mean and some examples of each?
Sure. So I'll just say that the concept of emotional curriculum is one that I developed in my analysis. And the concept of transformative learning actually comes from Jack Mesereau, who's a sociologist at Columbia. So with emotional curriculum, what I was trying to get at, what I kept seeing in my data was, were these parents who would say, well, I don't know if my kid is on track with like fourth grade math, but he knows how to communicate with people who don't speak his language, or he knows how to handle homesickness, or he is really good at coping with change. Or I don't know if my kid would, you know, like knows all the steps of scientific experimentation, but they've been learning these life lessons and gaining these like emotional intelligence. And so I began to pay attention to when parents would talk about what their kids were learning versus what their kids weren't learning or maybe weren't picking up. The focus tended to be on life lessons and emotional skills. Coping with change, dealing with homesickness, like handling discomfort, you know, handling being out of their comfort zones, expressing compassion, feeling gratitude, right? These became more important as parents were sort of thinking more in terms of character formation versus, oh, can you list all the presidents in order or something like that. So that was the emotional curriculum. And what I write about in the book is how really what parents are trying to do is teach their children how to feel global, right? So how to kind of feel, how to feel about themselves, about other people, and about their place in the world, in a way that they can kind of feel comfortable in different cultural settings and really sort of feel at home in the world. With transformative learning, this is an idea that Jack Mesro developed, and a lot of other scholars have developed it since then. This comes from the idea that learning should transform the learner, so that when you're learning something, you actually come out the other end kind of like a different person than you were when you started. So again, this isn't that kind of like rote memorization, but rather it's the type of learning that that changes who you are. And what's interesting about this, Mesro and his colleagues developed sort of like a list of the different phases that you go through in the process of transformative learning. And the first phase is encountering a disorienting dilemma. And I think that with world schooling, it's almost impossible to take your kids into a different cultural setting and not encounter a disorienting dilemma, right? And so, and then from there, the different phases take you through sort of like, you know, reflecting on the assumptions you have that make that dilemma disorienting, and questioning your own assumptions, and sort of putting a plan into place to act on this new knowledge that you've gained, and on and on. But that first step of the disorienting dilemma, I think, is interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
And examples of these. So with the emotional curriculum, one mother I was talking to, I talked to her and her family, and her kids were 10 and 12 when they were traveling. And she was telling me how they can kind of track, the kids sort of would have these periodic emotional meltdowns. Mm-hmm. I think her daughter was like on a 2-month cycle, and her son was like on a 3-month cycle. And like, you know, every so many weeks, this one's going to have a meltdown, then the next one's going to have a meltdown. And she said, you know, they just would miss their friends, or they would be homesick, or they just like wanted a hamburger, or they were overwhelmed by, you know, everything being different all the time. And she said to me, she's like, I don't want them to go through any pain. And yet at the same time, I know that those meltdowns are, that's like the big learning moment, right? That's when they're learning about themselves. They're learning how to kind of calibrate their emotions and to take stock of their emotional state and how to deal with change. And that's when they're really developing these skills. So it's like, you know, they kind of have to go through that in order to learn this emotional intelligence. With transformative learning, gosh, there's so many examples. I'm sure you can imagine examples too, right? The disorienting dilemmas that you face when you're traveling, like mm-hmm. walking into a bathroom and I've never seen a toilet like that before, right? So how do I do this? Or, you know, like telling Elliot he can go buy himself a snack, and he's looking at the snacks and he doesn't recognize any of them, right? So like, which one do you choose? Or to the more like cultural level disorienting dilemmas around, you know, gender roles, for example, or when we were in Thailand, we went to one of the Buddhist temples and had a conversation with a monk who kind of described Buddhism. And so that was kind of disorienting for Elliot to kind of hear the different things that the monks go through in their initiation and so forth. And another thing that was really interesting for us and for me especially was, you know, seeing how parents and families in different cultures do parenting, right? Like, oh yeah, just let the kids run down to the playground alone for hours on end. Or, oh yeah, we don't go eat dinner until 11 o'clock at night, even with the baby, right? And so so that's, I think that's just sort of like a constant state when you're traveling.
I think those are really important. I don't think that they're any less than the academic learning, which is why I find it interesting that you bring it up, because those areas are the areas that you focus on the child as a whole at this point, like the emotional level and building that grit and resilience. And sometimes I feel like you have to first build that foundation before the kid can get to like maybe the academic level. And I mean, I used to work in the schools, and it was the same thing, that the schools that I worked in were the population that we worked with. We had to really work first with that emotional level. So when you're saying that some of these world schooling families are like, you know, they're really, he's just not getting the science, but he's really good. You know, he's developed with, you know, his resilience, and that sometimes you need that in order to build that child up.
Yeah. She worked in down the road in the school system where you are right now, actually. So, and it also makes for an interesting human being, mm-hmm. right? That type of learning makes for an interesting person. Cause I know lots of really smart people that can't hold a conversation and they're probably missing that aspect of life. The cultural side of things, the part where you're growing up, where you actually communicate with people unlike yourself and figure out how to navigate that conversation and that communication. Well, when you miss out on those things in life, sometimes by the time you're an adult, it's very obvious that there's a hole somewhere in your education. It wasn't necessarily academic.
And I think what you're both touching on is sort of an anxiety that propels these families as well, which is, well, what are the skills my kid's going to need in 10, 20 years? Mm-hmm. Because, okay, so maybe they're taking a science class, or maybe they're learning computer coding, and maybe they're learning a coding language that isn't going to exist in 10 years, right? Or maybe they're learning math skills that aren't, something that isn't necessarily going to exist. Whereas I feel confident that if I teach them how to communicate with people who are different from themselves, I feel confident that if I teach them how to cope with change, those are skills that they will need. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like this coping with uncertainty, right? How do we prepare our kids the best we can, not knowing what's coming?
I was at a meeting not too long ago, and there was a person there who was trying to hire younger individuals for their company. And the main thing he wanted, and he told them this, was that he wanted people who were good with communication, that could actually hold a conversation with somebody, because he said, I can find plenty of people who are good with technology. I can find people who can code. I can find people who can do this and that and have degrees. The missing element is the person that has those things, but can also communicate with others, because we have customers that you have to communicate with. And the majority of the people coming in apparently could not. They were really good at those other things, but the one thing they were missing was that human interaction and that the communication skills, which I think comes from, like you said, those experiences being in uncomfortable positions and spots. And it doesn't have to always be in another country. You know, you could go from Ohio down to Miami, Florida, you're in a completely different culture, and navigating your way through Miami, Florida is going to teach you a whole lot of life lessons. It's just a different place. So it doesn't have to be world schooling, and it really can take place anywhere, or just in a different part of town. I can go down to downtown Cleveland and go to Little Italy. You know, you can go to where you're from down in Boston, you can go to you can travel around the world in downtown Boston and navigate those situations, which is, you know, an interesting place.
Yes, I agree. I think there's a quote in my book that you don't have to travel to get this kind of education, but it kind of expedites it.
Sure.
Right. But this can happen. This can happen at home. This can happen in your neighborhood. It can happen in a classroom, right? If it's put together that way.
Sure.
So speaking on uncertain times, what do you think the post-pandemic future may look like for these world schooling families?
I'm so curious. I know a lot of the families that I had been following had to kind of stop for a while, right? Settle into a place and sort of quarantine in a particular place. And I'm curious what you all are seeing too, in speaking with other homeschooling families and how they're coping with having homeschooling thrust upon them. I think, you know, some of the parents I'm in conversation with are frustrated beyond belief, and others are really excited. Mm-hmm. Because they've discovered that this actually works for their family and they want to keep doing it. And once you sort of unlock the geographical anchor of school, everything else can sort of become untethered, mm-hmm. too, for these families. So I'm curious to see if this is going to prompt a big trend toward world schooling, where people say, hey, we can do remote learning, we can do remote work. Why can't we be anywhere in the world? Are you seeing this with the families you're talking to?
Yeah, our last interview, it hasn't been released yet, but this one family, that's exactly what happened, was that the husband's job went remote. And then when they realized they did not like virtual learning at all, they were like, why don't we just take this on the road? You know, his job is now virtual. We don't like this type of learning for them. And they loved their school before. They said that because their school was a slightly alternative, but it had to go virtual. And one of their kids was begging to be homeschooled because he was so unhappy. And so they did. They took it to the road and
bought a van.
And now they're doing van life. And she said, you know, we're doing this for as long as the school is virtual. So they may go back to that school, and it's just for this situation. We've had other families that this was just the push for them to do this, and they may not look back again and continue homeschooling and traveling. I think what I've seen a lot though of lately is because so many areas are still shut down in our world, that we see a lot of road schooling within the country, or at least within North America. A lot of people are going to Mexico right now.
Yeah, just about every traveling family we've talked to is actually in Mexico right now, in the same spot, yes. Pretty much.
Looking for that experience, but can drive there.
Right, and it's apparently it's friendly to travelers, the area that they are, so it's well known within that community, so they're all kind of flocking there. But yeah, you see that the majority of people cannot stand, and the kids along with them cannot stand virtual learning. However, when they shift to homeschooling or whatever you want to call it that they're doing on their own, that's when it's like the game changer, that they realize like, okay, this is different than schooling from home and being connected to the computer all day and listening to, the curriculum online all day long. But when they change to homeschooling or road schooling, everyone that we've spoken with, I'm sure it's not, of course, it's not everybody, but they've seen their kids thrive, mm-hmm. in different ways, mm-hmm. kind of like you had mentioned.
So this, it'll be really interesting to track this trend coming out of the pandemic. Also, right before the pandemic, I was noticing that the trend among homeschooling and world schooling was to become more inclusive. I think the homeschooling and world schooling community has been vastly white, but I've seen a lot more African-American and Black families doing this as well. So it'll be interesting to see if that trend continues post-pandemic as well.
I know your work is about to get way more interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll finish up here with two more questions. We know you're busy, so we'll get to it. But we ask a variation of this question to all of our guests because it's kind of a fun question. But if you knew you would lose your ability to communicate tomorrow, what's one last piece of wisdom you'd like to leave for the world? That could be on it.
This is such a poignant question, my goodness. But what I was thinking about was in the book I highlight, there's this paradox among world schoolers when they talk about the future. They talk about the future as uncertain, unknowable, right? It's like coming at us. But at the same time, they talk about the future as an object of design, right? As something we can craft. And so I was thinking, I think that one word of wisdom would be to sort of lean into that paradox, right? Like stay in a place where you can be surprised by the future, but also don't necessarily think of it as something that just happens to us, but as something that we can create. And more importantly, something we can create together. I think if we work together to create a brighter future, not just for my kid or for my family, but for all of us, that would be my parting wish, I guess, to the world.
Love it.
Yeah, it was perfect. So where can our listeners find you and your research? And then when your book comes out, can they find that?
Right. So you can find me online at holycross.edu. You can search for me there. And the book is coming out next month with NYU Press. You can find it at nyupress.org and wherever books are sold.
And can you share the title one more time?
Yes. It is called The World is Our Classroom, Extreme Parenting and the Rise of World Schooling.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much. We enjoyed this.
Yes.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. I appreciate it.
All right. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Same to you.
Bye.
Bye.
We want to thank Jenny for taking the time to speak with us. She was such a pleasure to speak with, and her research really helped solidify what we all already know. Alternative education will not harm our children or leave them behind. We also want to thank all of you for joining us week after week, and if you enjoy the show, please leave a review. If you have any questions or comments, please send us an email at thehomeschoolprojectpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, let's light a fire they can't put out.